And this is great to see this crowd out here tonight, really. Thank you for coming. Thank you for all the people that worked hard on this, for this particular occasion. Lots of people put a lot of hard work in it, and I want to thank, before he even begins, Chris Hedges for coming here and giving us this lecture tonight. Now, like they do at the Clay Center, if you have one of those things that beeps or blinks or whatever it does, please turn it off. A couple of other announcements before we get into the program. Chris will be signing books afterwards at the back like he did before. I also have some information I've been asked to make announcements about. One is that that this presentation tonight is being streamed. It's a dangerous term to use around here in this kind of weather, but that's what it means. It'll be up on audio and video. If you're making notes, it will be audio is on headonradionetwork.com. That's headonradionetwork.com. If you're working on the video part of it, it's on ustream.tv. Ustream.tv. Bob Kincaid, thank you for doing this for us tonight here. We really appreciate it. One more announcement in the House. I think this is a really good one to make. I was asked to make this announcement. Just across the hall, across the way here in this building, there is an exhibition called Marching Toward Justice. You saw the big banner as you came in here. It's an exhibit, and there will be it will be open through April 15th, and there will be a speaker here, I think this Thursday night, someone here who gave me the notice, help me. Okay. There'll be information in the back. This is an important exhibit, and so take a look at it between now and April 15th, because it has to do with the 14th Amendment. You know, that amendment some are trying to get rid of in the Constitution. And so I invite you to see it and get information in the back about when the speaker's coming in and sign the guest book. All right, I think that takes care of all the announcements. This is such a pleasure to do this tonight. It's going to be a very brief introduction because you came here to hear Chris Hedges tonight, and so did I. And the way to start this from my vantage point tonight is simply this, that in the middle 1980s, when it was very difficult in this country to get anything but handout news that found its way from the American Embassy in El Salvador into the hands of some people who were journalists, called journalists in Central America at that time, and then fed back to us here in the States. And it was during the middle 80s, while I was visiting in El Salvador with a group of people, that I had the opportunity to meet Chris Hedges. And it was a real pleasure, because at least it brought some hope to me that I was going to be able to go back home, come back here to home, and be able to get some real information. And I've lived off of Chris's writings since that time. I look for bylines, and you get a list of these people that you know you can trust. Doesn't mean they're always right. It just means you can trust them. This is not something the American Embassy is handing out to you through some journalist that sits at the pool. No. This is a man who has been out in the field and close to the ground, and that's where his vantage point is, and that's what we get from him. I want to read two paragraphs by way of introduction. I'm not going to go through his long list of accomplishments. This is a man that speaks a number of languages, has taught a number of places. He's talking about Princeton today earlier, and who has published a number of books, a number of them are on sale in the back. I hope you will pick up books. If you haven't read his books, please do. The one that really has been instrumental in my way of thinking about the wars that we are in has been the book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Think of that title, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. And it's available in the back. I want to read you one paragraph. He's talking about the Vietnam Wall. Vietnam Veterans Memorial is so important. It was not a project funded or organized by the state, but by those who survived and insisted we not forget. It was part of America's battle back to truth, part of our desire for forgiveness. It ultimately held out to us as a nation the opportunity for redemption, although the state has prodded us back toward the triumphalism that led us into Vietnam. But just as the oppressors engage in selective memory and myth, so do the victims, building unassailable monuments to their own suffering. It becomes impossible to examine, to dispute, or to criticize the myths that have grown up around the past sufferings of nearly all in war. The oppressors are painted by the survivors as monsters. The victims paint themselves as holy innocents. The oppressors work hard to bury inconvenient facts and brand all in wartime with the pitch of atrocity. They strive to reduce victims to their moral level. Each side creates its own narrative. Neither is fully true. Chris has been all over in any number of wars. He's covered from the ground. I already said El Salvador, but all over. For National Public Radio, the Dallas Morning News, the New York Times, the Christian Science Monitor, a whole host of papers. He writes now and online with Truth Dig. If you don't know Truth Dig, go dig in Truth Dig. This is a man that knows something about war. He knows a lot about war because he's covered these wars right on the ground, up close and personal. And I know he'll be speaking about some of that tonight. So we're going to get some real honest conversation about war here tonight. One final quote. This is from his new book, Death of the Liberal Class. Brief parrot. I love this parrot piece because it reminds me of Bill Stringfellow, who was an Episcopal layman lawyer, who was one of the saints in my book. And I know Chris drew from Bill Stringfellow as well. He's dead now. Because Bill was always writing about resistance, and you're going to hear about resistance tonight. That's what, if you go out of here with one word on your lips tonight, it'll be resistance. A quick paragraph. This is from the book. Acts of resistance are moral acts. They take place because people of conscience understand the moral rather than the practical imperative of rebellion. They should be carried out not because they are effective, but because they are right. Those who begin these acts are always few. They are dismissed by those in the liberal class who hide their cowardice behind their cynicism. Resistance, however marginal, affirms the sanctity of individual life in a world awash in death. It is a supreme act of faith, the highest form of spirituality. Those who have carried out great acts of resistance in the past sacrificed their security and their comfort, often spent time in jail, and in some cases were killed. They understood that to live in the fullest sense of the word, to exist as free and independent human beings, even under the darkest night of state repression, means to defy injustice. Any act of resistance is its own justification. It cannot be measured by its utilitarian effect, and the acts of resistance that sustain us morally are those that disrupt systems of power, but do not violate the sanctity of human life. Even finally, the lives of those who enslave us. You came tonight to hear Chris, and he's going to address you now. Nothing will escape his scrutiny. And I couldn't help but think of the biblical line, you know, trying to take the speck out of someone else's eye when you have the beam of it in your own. Every single one of us, no matter what organizations we are, no matter what work we do, need to come under the scrutiny of the moral codes with which we hold the signs and banners which we carry. And this is a man who holds all of our feet to the fire and hopefully ignites passion, rekindles passion in us to continue acts of resistance and to stand up to the powers that be. It is a real, real, real pleasure for me to introduce to you Chris Hedges.
Thank you. I'm going to talk a little bit about the themes in the new book, Death of the Liberal Class, and what led me to write it. I had been asked by Knopf, a large publishing house, to do a book on the press, State of the Media, which I subsequently learned as a writer, one should never write books of someone else's idea. The Ford Foundation kicked in a grant, and like most writers, the money was too good to turn it down. So I did. I wrote, of course, spent more than two decades working as a journalist, 15 of them with the New York Times, and turned in the manuscript, and Knopf read it and hated it, and said that they would publish it, but only after they had assigned an editor to take out all the negativity. So I scrambled to get another publisher, Nation Books, to buy it, since I wasn't going to let Knopf deform it. What they wanted, of course, was the mythic version of the press, without fear and favor, the Pentagon Papers, Watergate. And while I do believe that the death of mainstream commercial journalism is a body blow to our democracy, at the same time, I couldn't justify covering up for the gross inadequacies of the commercial press, which I knew far better than Knopf. And in this transition period between moving from one publisher to another, I reflected back on the process of writing that book and the constraints that I felt, because of course the press hardly exists in a vacuum. Why doesn't the press cover labor? Every major newspaper in this country used to have a labor correspondent. Well, that is of course because labor has withered away as a force, and what's left of labor in terms of public sector unions and teachers' unions are now brutal assault across the country, including in the state of New Jersey where I live. What about the voice that liberal religious institutions had in the 1960s? My father, certainly the man by whom I to this day set the standards for everything that I do, was a Presbyterian minister who was a vet. He was a sergeant in North Africa in World War II and came back from the war all but a pacifist, I think pretty close to a pacifist, hated the military, hated war, of course, and was very outspoken against the war. I lived grew up in a small white farm town in upstate New York. I remember my dad telling me when I was about 12 that if the war was still being fought when I was 18 and I was drafted, he would go to prison with me. And to this day, I still have a vision of sort of sitting in a jail cell with my dad for 2 years. He was very vocal in his support of the civil rights movement. I remember as a young child watching people walk out of his church. We had no people of color in the farm town that I lived in. This was at a time in the early 60s when Martin Luther King was probably one of the most hated men in America in rural white enclaves. And then, amazingly, and I only tell all these stories to talk about, for me, that powerful influence I think true Christian witness has. My dad was an outspoken supporter of gay rights. His youngest brother, my uncle, was gay and lived with his partner in Greenwich Village, had been all but disowned by his family, except my dad, who we were all the family he and his partner Arthur had. And I think for all of the stances my father took, that's the one for which he actually paid the hugest price. To stand up in the 1970s and call for the marriage and ordination of gays in the Presbyterian Church was a singularly courageous act, and one that was not tolerated by his congregations. And he was driven out of one church after another. He had a church in Syracuse, New York, when I was an undergraduate at Colgate, which was liberal arts college about an hour away. And when my father found that there was no gay and lesbian organization at Colgate, he drove gay activists to the campus. And I, who was certainly one of the most committed heterosexuals at Colgate, would sit in these small groups to discuss respect for other ways of being. After several of these meetings, my father was encouraging gays on campus to publicly form an organization, but they were too frightened to come out of the closet, and that was a problem that my dad finally solved by driving down one afternoon and taking me to lunch and telling me that I had to found it. So I founded the Gay and Lesbian Alliance at Colgate University. I never attended, but it had my name on it every Tuesday. And when I would go into the dining hall and have my card checked off for breakfast, lunch, or dinner, the guy would hand it back to me and go, "Faggot." So I made it my undergraduate mission to seduce his girlfriend. My father was pretty much hounded out of the church. By the end of his career, the only job he could get for the stances that he took was as a chaplain in a juvenile facility. He taught me many things, and one of the most important was that your institutions don't reward you for virtue. That when you take a moral stance, don't expect to be applauded, even by the institutions you're most intimately connected with, and certainly by the Christian church. I watched that great moral voice. I remember going to anti-war demonstrations. We would drive into the capital of Albany and listening to Pete Seeger sing. And I've been involved in the recent demonstrations in Washington sponsored by Veterans for Peace and Iraq Veterans Against the War, where about in December and then on the 8th anniversary of the war in Iraq, about 130 people went and were arrested on the White House fence. And I think one of the saddest moments for me in both of these, in these last two demonstrations, is how few clergy are there. What's happened to the church? The press itself, of course, has been largely corporatized. The electronic media has disintegrated into trivia, gossip, these kind of bizarre soap opera sagas with disturbed figures like Charlie Sheen. Every week it's somebody new. We went through Britney Spears and Michael Jackson, and the journalism itself is withering. The monopoly that newsprint once had, connecting with sellers with buyers, is gone. So that major metropolitan dailies, when you go to cities like Philadelphia or Dallas or Chicago or Baltimore, are just anemic. And many, of course, of the largest papers, like the Philly paper or the San Francisco Chronicle, are bankrupt and struggling. The Chronicle is losing about $1 million a week. Labor, I don't have to tell anyone in this room what's happened to labor. That Denise has written about this. But the way the United Mine Workers at one point stood up to the coal companies, and then the way they sold them out, which is what she documents so beautifully in Unquiet Earth. Public education has been destroyed. The great public universities began with Rockefeller's dismantling of City College in New York. I was just out at University of Washington, and they had 10% budget cuts imposed by the state, and of course a gleaming business school. And what did they do rather than cut across the board, they abolished the theater and the philosophy department. University of Albany has just done the same things, so erased or closed all the departments that deal with foreign languages, the classics. Liberal arts education in this country is dying. And it's dying because education has become purely vocational and corporatized. I've taught at Princeton. Princeton is a corporation. And these kids are funneled straight from Princeton to Wall Street. I mean, one of the most sort of darkly ironic comments of Barack Obama's State of the Union speech was his bemoaning our educational system because that's what has not allowed us to keep up. Well, the financial meltdown was orchestrated by the most highly educated class within the United States, including that repugnant figure Larry Summers, who was the president of Harvard, the youngest tenured economics professor at 37 in the university. What trashed the global economy, $40 trillion of wealth, $17 trillion in wages and benefits, almost all taken from small shareholders, many who are probably sitting in this room, was a consequence of human greed, not a lack of education. And in public universities, as they are further cut, you have departments who are told that they have to raise all of their own grant money, research money, salaries. And who pays? Where do they go? Who are they in the service of? All of the great body of the humanities, which are about transformation, which are Socratic in the sense that they force us to challenge structures and assumptions, that relentless kind of questioning of all authority, all power systems, are dying. Only 100,000 students last year graduated with humanities degrees. And of course now with the proliferation of online universities, it purely serves the needs of the corporate elite. It creates a kind of caste system. If you go to Princeton, you can go work for Goldman Sachs. If you grow up in a poor area of southern West Virginia or Camden, New Jersey, then you are educated enough to be basically literate to carry out essentially minimal wage jobs in places like Walmart or someplace else without benefits. And of course, the Democratic Party itself has consciously decided to walk out on working men and women to serve corporate interests. This was begun under Bill Clinton, who articulated within the Democratic leadership this understanding that if the Democrats did corporate Binney, they'd get corporate money. So that by the 90s, the Democrats had fundraising parity with the Republicans, and by the time Barack Obama ran for president, they got more. And now you see he's called on 700 donors to bundle. He's talking about a $1 billion campaign chest from the rich. So it wasn't just the press that had collapsed. It was the main pillars of the liberal establishment had collapsed, all of them. And I expanded the book to look at the liberal class itself. And it drove me back to World War I and Woodrow Wilson, who I think comes through as a very dark figure in American history. Wilson, who campaigned for re-election in 1912 on the slogan, "He kept us out of the war," by 1917 was receiving heavy pressure from Wall Street and bankers who had lent tremendous sums of money to the British and the French and were terrified that with the collapse of the Russian front and the transfer of German divisions towards the Western Front, the British and French would lose the war and they would never be repaid. Now, the war had no popular support at all. Dwight MacDonald, a writer I admire very much, who It's a great story about McDonough. If any of them ever read McDonough, but he's just a beautiful writer, and he's very smart. And for 5 years, ran a magazine called Politics, which Noam Chomsky said was his political awakening, reading Politics, publishing Bettelheim and Orwell and Hannah Arendt, just a remarkable list of intellectuals. McDonald, who was a real iconoclast and finally an anarchist, briefly flirted with the Trotskyite party, but kept writing such unorthodox articles in the Trotskyite publications that finally Trotsky himself wrote a letter from Mexico throwing him out of the party, which had this line in it saying, "Everybody has a right to their own stupidities, but Comrade McDonald abuses the privilege." McDonald, there are a couple really smart intellectual histories of that sort of period from, you know, before the war. I mean, two of the great writers are Randolph Bourne and Jane Addams, who get what's happened. But MacDonald and Malcolm Cowley in his sort of intellectual memoir, An Exile's Return, write about how, and these are MacDonald's words, that the war was the rock on which progressive populist movements broke. And that's precisely what happened. On the eve of World War I, we had powerful movements, socialist movements, anarchist, if you want to call the Wobblies anarchists, probably they were, communist, that had terrified the power elite in this country. And we had massive socialist publications that had massive circulation. Appeal to Reason, which Eugene Debs and others wrote for, was the fourth most read publication in this country, the masses. And it's when you go back and read the memoirs of Bourne and Adams, they talk about how the war hysteria and the propaganda that was created under the Committee for Public Information, or popularly known as the Creel Commission, not only seduced the masses, but seduced so many of the intellectual elite themselves, that people replaced that concrete drive for justice, whether it was around organizing in the tenements on the Lower East Side or building unions among textile workers in Lowell, Massachusetts, for the more abstract vision of making the world safe for democracy. And that left essentially a few individuals and a few groups that were very easily broken with the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act. And, of course, is what drove Debs into prison. And the Committee for Public Information becomes a fascinating. I went through a lot of the archives by the founders of the Committee for Public Information are actually in Princeton, and I went through a lot of the papers of a guy named Boulard, Arthur Boulard, who with Walter Lippmann was pretty much the driving force behind the creation of the Committee for Public Information. And Lippmann comes off as a brilliant but very dark figure in this period, especially his 1922 book, Public Opinion, where he talks about the way you can manufacture consent, the power of propaganda to manufacture consent. And because they had government resources behind them, the Committee for Public Information was able to set up its own news division that pumped out daily pro-war news stories that were picked up by papers across the country. It had its own film division, which pretty much paid for itself. Hollywood was churning out these movies like The Kaiser, The Butcher of Berlin. I had speakers bureaus, three-minute men, they call them, 45,000 speakers that just traveled the country giving pro-war messages. But most importantly about the Creel Commission and the reason that it marked such a break with other systems of propaganda is they exploited the studies of mass psychology that had been made by Le Bon, Trotter, and Freud. And Edward Bernays, who becomes the father of sort of modern public relations, came out of the Creel Commission. He was actually Freud's nephew twice over through his mother and his aunt, I guess, or something. And it was Bernays' book, written right after the war, called Propaganda, that was one of the seminal texts that Goebbels studied when he built the Nazi propaganda machine. And they knew that people were not moved by fact or reason, but by the manipulation of emotion. and they employed all of these techniques to not only build support for a war where there was no support, but to discredit those radical and populist movements that had stood against the war. And it worked. As MacDonald again points out, none of the social or political theorists, including Karl Marx, of the late 19th century, had anticipated what would happen when you thrust a society into a state of permanent war psychosis, permanent fear. So that the moment the war is over, thousands of employees from the Creel Commission go off to Madison Avenue and start working public relations for corporations and hear Malcolm Cowley's book, I think, is a fascinating because he's actually living in Greenwich Village at the time. He'd been an ambulance driver in World War I. Of course, I knew him originally because he edited all of, he was Faulkner's editor. And the moment the war ends, the dreaded Hun is replaced by the dreaded Red. And so some of the worst assaults against these populist forces come in the years right after the war with the Palmer raids, appeal to reason, even though it accepted, it was forced to throughout the war have a pro-war editorial policy is closed down, the masses are closed down, the Wobblies are broken, Big Bill Haywood has to flee on trumped up murder charges the same way they executed Joe Hill, spends the last 10 years of his life in kind of very lonely exile in Moscow. And so we began this assault on those forces that were the true correctives to American democracy. All the correctives to American democracy, and I think Zinn has been quite good in describing this. I, by the way, taught his last summer. I'm going to teach again this summer. I teach in a prison, and I taught, they're all African Americans. In New Jersey, they segregate the prisons by gang affiliation, so this is a Bloods, they're all Bloods. But I taught, the great thing about, there is a benefit to having most of America being largely illiterate. I told the prison staff I wanted to teach American history, and then I bought all the inmates copies of the People's History of the United States. All of the correctives to American democracy came through movements. The Liberty Party that fought slavery, the suffragists, labor movement, civil rights movement. None of them ever achieved formal political power. They understood something that I think the liberal class has forgotten, and that is that insight by the philosopher Karl Popper, that the question is not how do you get good people to rule? That's the wrong question. Most people attracted to power, as Popper writes, are at best are mediocre, which is Obama, or venal, which is Bush. The only question is how do you make the powerful afraid of you? Something John Lewis understood. And they were able to destroy these movements. And they were able to destroy internally those figures within the liberal class who had any kind of a conscience in the name of anti-communism. It's how they discredit a figure like Henry Wallace, one of the architects of the New Deal, Roosevelt's vice president, ran as a presidential candidate in 48 and is banished within the American political landscape, tarred with the brush of being soft on communism. I had an email from a professor at Princeton about 2 or 3 days ago in which he wrote me, he read Death of the Liberal Class. He didn't like the book any more than Knopf. And because he said he felt like he was being attacked. And in a way, I think he didn't understand the book. I'm not a liberal, and yet I understand that the liberal class plays a vital role in a functioning democracy because it creates a mechanism by which incremental or piecemeal reform is made possible. It needs pressure from those. It was all of those popular movements that kept the liberal class honest. We wouldn't have had the New Deal if we hadn't had the sit-down strikes, if we hadn't had the bonus marchers, if we hadn't had the Communist Party. And with the decimation of those popular movements, the liberal class, which traditionally had been the center within the political spectrum, got moved to the left. And that relentless drumbeat of permanent war, as Dwight MacDonald points out, saw liberal institutions continuously disembowel themselves of anybody who had any kind of a moral conscience. Or certainly, maybe that's unfair, people may have had a conscience, but who had the tenacity to stand up and defy systems of power. So that we saw, especially after World War II, the final assault against liberal institutions. The popular movements had been largely destroyed. The old CIO, and you had the AFL-CIO purged, so that it, by the 1960s, the disconnect between labor and the anti-war movement was vast. I mean, the Elaine Kirkland and George Meany were ridiculing the demonstrators out in the street and officially declaring the Union's support for the war in Indochina, not to mention sending all sorts of AFL-CIO representatives to Latin America to break quote-unquote communist unions. And so thousands of people in the aftermath of World War II, through the McCarthy hearings, lost their jobs in universities, in journalism, in the State Department, in high schools, social workers. And many of them, of course, had nothing to do with communism. It's how a figure like I.F. Stone, who arguably is, you know, perhaps the greatest journalist of the 20th century, because he won't take Truman's loyalty oath, becomes instantly a pariah and can't even get a job at The Nation magazine and founds I.F. Stone's in the basement of his house. So we lost those popular progressive movements that never sought power but organized around moral imperatives, whether it was women's rights, whether it was civil rights, whether it was decent and fair working conditions for men and women. And the liberal class constantly purged itself. And who was carrying out the purges? As with all situations, it was those who were building their own career at the expense of people who were trying to hold fast to principles that could be labeled as subversive. A figure like Sidney Hook becomes a perfect example of this. Hook, a former Trotskyite, sets himself up in the 50s and 60s to willingly, along with a former head of the ACLU, to drive people in liberal institutions out into the margins and make them outcasts. Now, this coincided with what the historian Charles Mayer at Harvard calls the transformation in American society from an empire of production to an empire of consumption. That by the 1970s, as manufacturing jobs began to decline, and of course wages for most Americans have either remained stagnant or declined since the 70s, we were given credit and access to cheap mass-produced goods. There's a very fine book that I like very much called Democracy Incorporated by the political philosopher Sheldon Wolin, who's probably our greatest living political philosopher. He taught at Berkeley and later Princeton. And in it, Wolin uses the term inverted totalitarianism to describe the transformation of our system. And in inverted totalitarianism, it's different from classical totalitarianism in that you're not ruled by a demagogue or a charismatic leader. Inverted totalitarianism finds its expression in the anonymity of the corporate state. In inverted totalitarianism, you don't have a radical or reactionary force that overthrows a decaying structure and replaces it with a new iconography and language. You have corporate forces that purport to pay fealty to the Constitution, to electoral politics, to the iconography and language of traditional American patriotism, and yet have seized the internal levers of power as to render the citizenry impotent. John Ralston Saul, Canadian philosopher, wrote a couple great books. One of them is Voltaire's Bastards. He describes this process as a coup d'etat in slow motion. And I think that's right. What we have undergone, starting in the 70s, accelerated by figures like Clinton, perpetuated by figures like Bush and Obama, is a coup d'etat in slow motion. A destruction of those forces within the society, those recognized forces in the society that were once able to respond to the grievances and injustices felt by working men and women. I'm not pretending that they responded always fairly. The reason the liberal class was traditionally tolerated by the power elite is because it set the parameters for discussion. When there became widespread discontent with the breakdown of capitalism, it created the New Deal. But it thwarted a critique of capitalism itself. Conrad Black, in his biography of Roosevelt, I think says correctly that Roosevelt's greatest achievement was that he saved capitalism. And so the liberal class, which sets itself up as the public conscience of the nation, works within parameters that do not threaten the power elite itself. And that is why they are traditionally tolerated, or were traditionally tolerated, within the universities, within liberal religious institutions, within the Democratic Party, within the press, and within labor. The figure that self-identified liberals in this country hate the most is not Glenn Beck. It's Noam Chomsky. Because Chomsky has spent a career calling the liberal class out for their collaboration. I give you an example, and you can do it either with the Vietnam War or the Iraq War. Remember, at the beginning of the Iraq War, we had all the reluctant hawks, David Remnick at The New Yorker, Michael Ignatieff, Bill Keller, who was a columnist and now is the executive editor of The New York Times, who wrung their hands and said, war is awful, but we must do it. It's a moral imperative. And they give a kind of moral veneer to what we now know was a crime. And then when it goes wrong, they won't go back and critique the motives or the aims of a Wolfowitz, a Pearl, a Cheney. They'll talk about how we weren't prepared for the insurgency, or we didn't have enough troops for the occupation. When you cross that line and begin to assault the motives and aims of the power elite, you are instantly banished by the liberal class itself. And that, I think there is probably no better example in American public life of that than Ralph Nader, who's a very close friend of mine, and who I have supported on every single run for president. I gave a talk at the University of Wisconsin, and somebody got up and said, but his speeches are so boring. And I had to confess, this is the last election, I wrote all his speeches. I thought they were scintillating myself. I think that those of us who care about these values forgot what you know, Mother Jones could have told us, that it's not our job to take power. You know, there's a great book by Julian Benda called Treason of the Intellectuals, French writer, written in the 20s. And he said everybody has a choice between two sets of values that they serve. You can choose to serve truth and justice or privilege and power. The more you cooperate, the more you work with those who serve the values of privilege and power, the more you diminish your own capacity to promote truth and justice. And I think that there's a great truth in that. Now the danger is that when that safety valve closes, when you begin to thrust a society into tremendous dislocation, as we are doing, 6 million people in this country in the last 2 years have been driven from their homes because of bank repossessions and foreclosures by corporations like Bank of America, who, by any judicial yardstick, carried out criminal, fraudulent activity in terms of subprime mortgages. Remember, as Charlie Mayer said, we built an economy based on consumption, and the engine for that consumption was credit. Wolin says that that credit and those cheap manufactured goods were the political mechanisms by which they thwarted resistance to the rise of the corporate state and the destruction of our own of traditional civil liberties, including, let's not forget, habeas corpus, which Obama and the Democrats have not found it convenient to reinstate. And with the loss of that credit, and as the mass-produced goods become too expensive, I actually called Wolin and asked him and said, you know, if these mechanisms of control, as you call them, disappear, then do we flip from a form of inverted totalitarianism to, a system that is more rightly called a classical totalitarianism? And he said yes. He thought that was right. So we have a process now by which, 40, 45 million Americans, and let's remember that the kind of Potemkin figures put out by the federal government mask the extent of the poverty and deprivation in this country, but roughly 45 million Americans already are classified as living in poverty. Tens of millions of Americans live in a category called near poverty. The numbers are 1 million people in this country went bankrupt last year because they couldn't pay their medical bills. You know, capitalists should not be allowed anywhere near a healthcare system. It's legally permitted in the United States for a corporation to hold a sick child hostage, while their parents bankrupt themselves, trying to save their sons or daughters. That's what we've come to. 45,000 Americans died last year because they couldn't get proper medical care, as if illness is a consumer choice. And now we're watching the Obama administration hand out exemption after exemption because these corporations do not want to insure chronically ill children. The reconfiguration of American society by both parties into a kind of neo-feudalism, coupled with the death of the liberal class, means that the traditional mechanism by which change was possible, it was never enough change, but at least it was some change, no longer works. And the writer, interestingly enough, who was obsessed with this danger, was Dostoevsky. Demons is about this. Notes from Underground. Notes from Underground is the disillusioned believer who went to all the rallies and chanted, "Yes, we can," and has now gone underground in cynicism and realized that it's only fools and idiots who achieve power and washes their hands of it. Which is why Obama is tacking as far to the right as fast as he can. And Dostoevsky said that when the mechanism by which reform is no longer possible is killed off, you enter what he called an age of moral nihilism. You create movements that satisfy an emotional need but are utterly irrational politically, which is, of course, what the Tea Party is. The Tea Party expresses not only a rage, but I would argue a legitimate rage on the part of American men and women. And a legitimate rage at the liberal class that betrayed them. I think that rage is legitimate. And yet, the solution they offer makes no sense. Because although they want to get government off their backs, nobody wants to abolish Social Security, nobody wants to abolish Medicare, nobody wants to abolish Medicaid, nobody wants unemployment benefits to be cut off. Nobody wants to in any way impede the military, the security and surveillance state, as if the military isn't part of government. And of course, it is captivated and manipulated by demagogic figures in the same way the Christian right is, who channel this rage towards, and this I watched this in the breakdown of Yugoslavia, to the weakest within society. Muslims, undocumented workers, homosexuals. The language that they use is one replete with all of the slogans and jargon of the language of war, a celebration of the gun culture. And I've covered enough conflicts to know that the language of violence in a deteriorating society inevitably leads to violence itself. And we were speaking the other night with a friend of mine who's a teacher, professor at College of New Jersey, about the breakdown. And I fear that at a moment when we need not only liberal institutions but those popular movements that held fast moral imperatives, which were the weapons that protected us in the 1930s from swinging towards fascism, we've been utterly disarmed. That the corporate state knows no check. Carl Polanyi wrote a wonderful book in 1944 called The Great Transformation. He was an economist. And he talks about how unregulated or unfettered or unchecked capitalism turns everything into a commodity, including human beings, of course, and the natural world, that it exploits until exhaustion or collapse. When you unleash, and Marx understood this, that unleashed capitalism was a revolutionary force. When you unleash these forces, you cannibalize the country. And that's why the environmental crisis is intimately twinned with the economic crisis. Because the forces that have rendered us powerless, that have taken control of all of our branches of government, whether it's the Supreme Court decision for Citizens United, whether it is the garbage that is spewed forth on Fox and cable news channels, whether it is a compliant legislative body that will not vote against corporate interests, and the Democrats have been as awful on this as the Republicans, then there is no check on what I think in theological terms can rightly be called systems of death. They're systems of death. And I'll end just talking a little bit about resistance. I was in New York yesterday with Father Daniel Berrigan, who will turn 90 in May. He baptized my daughter, who's 2 months old. And I've been taking part in these demonstrations in Washington where, there was a scene in Unquiet Earth where the character Dylan goes to Washington to visit his daughter, and there are demonstrations, and Dylan had spent 2 years, I think, in jail, or 3 years or something, for blowing up a railroad bridge, and was sort of dismissing, I think correctly, the choreographed arrests that I take part in, the boutique activism, where the police all know in advance what you're going to do. They're very polite. They'll actually come and say, "Who wants to be arrested now?" People will line up, put their hands behind their back, get their picture taken, go off and pay $100. Nobody gets held overnight unless they don't pay the fine. It's essentially the equivalent of a jaywalking ticket. And I told Berrigan that, I'm doing this, and I'll... anybody here work for Bank of America? We're going to go shut down one of the Bank of America branches in New York on April 15th. That won't be choreographed because they don't know we're going to do it. So yeah, we may not get treated quite politely by the New York City police. But I told Berrigan this. Remember, Berrigan, spent many years in jail. His brother Phil, by the time he died, had spent 11 years in jail. And I saw a great speech by Wendell Berry, who I've only spoken to by phone, but I admire him very much as a writer and a thinker and a moral, just a great moral conscience. When he talked about how civil disobedience is all we have left, and he said, going to jail is more time than I care to donate. Going to a federal penitentiary is more time, for a few years is far more time than I care to donate. I expressed that to Berrigan, that I think for those of us who, are held in very easy conditions for a few hours, does it really mean anything? Does it do anything? I have to be honest. I mean, I've been working with this great writer and illustrator, Joe Sacco, who's here tonight, along with Denise, and we're going back down to southern West Virginia. Southern West Virginia disturbed me very much. First of all, because you can't, I'd read about mountaintop removal, but I had no idea. You can't understand the scale of it till you go. And Joe and I are driving through towns like Jenkin Jones. We worked in Bosnia together, and we just kept thinking we were back in Bosnia. It physically looks like Bosnia. It's a process of ethnic cleansing. It may be a process of genocide. It's certainly a process of ethnic cleansing. And one of the things that disturbs me, and I have so much respect for all of you who have stood up to Massey and these war criminals like Blankenship, is that the assault is relentless, and the constant appeals that are made in a civilized and respectful way are ignored. One of the most disturbing things for me leaving McDowell and Logan and these counties is the realization that these people have a right to use violence. against these coal companies. I can't do it because I know what violence does to you. I know the poison that violence is. And yet, I'm not a pacifist because I lived in Sarajevo. I know that there are forces of annihilation, and that is always the tragedy of violence, that when you descend there, you know, the people who employ violence, even in a supposedly just cause, as Nietzsche pointed out, means you pit your monsters against their monsters. But I certainly believe that it's gone that far. These people will not stop until they turn that area into an utter wasteland. And how many children, how many people will they poison and kill? It's irrelevant. They are an unleashed, a predatory force. They are, you know, as Polanyi said, that when you have no restrictions on capitalism, you end up with a mafia economic system and a mafia government. And I think we who care about the protection of civil liberties, the protection of our environment, the protection of working men and women, have to take a lesson from the radicals of another era and from the great religious figures like Berrigan. And that is that we are not called to the practical. We are not called to be part of the inner sanctum of power. We are not called to make compromises on moral issues. We are called to fight day in and day out around these moral imperatives, no matter what the cost. And when I spoke to Berrigan and told him about my misgivings and about being a boutique activist, he had a kind of wry smile, as somebody who spent several years in a federal penitentiary would have, and said, and yet, when you, every time you hold one of these events, you don't know, and you may never know, who came to that event and was transformed, who was nervous, who had never stepped out, who stood with those activists, and who from those activists gained a kind of courage to keep going. And maybe that's it. Maybe we only change one person at a time. We, in December, in Lafayette Park in front of the White House, heavy snowfall. 500, mostly vets, Vietnam vets, Iraq vets, Afghan vets, many in their uniforms. When it came time to march to the White House, a great blues artist named Watermelon Slim pulled out his mouth harp and played taps. Everybody fell silent. A family whose boy was killed in Afghanistan had brought a flag, an American flag. It was folded into a triangle. Every one of those veterans formed a single line. Somebody beat slowly on a drum, and we marched to the White House fence. And as someone who intimately knows the trauma of war and bears that cross and will always bear that cross, I can tell you that almost everyone was crying. And when we got to the fence, when the cops came to put the plastic handcuffs on us, almost all of them had served in Iraq and Afghanistan. And when they cuffed us, they put us in the back of the vans, they said, "Keep doing what you're doing because you're right about the war." Thank you. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to do a Q&A, if you're interested. Okay. Martha, this is not. Are you ready? Okay, just a second.
What was the charge when you went to the White House?
In Washington when we were arrested? It was the equivalent of they gave us like a ticket. I mean, we were arrested by the, officially arrested by the Park Service. It was like a jaywalking charge. We had to all paid $100 when we got out. We got like to spend a few hours in a holding tank and then we got out about 7 at night.
Unlawful assembly or
I didn't look at it. I just gave them the money and left. Okay. I didn't really look at the details. I was sort of ready to get out of there.
I thought we were allowed to demonstrate. I thought we were allowed to do that.
Well, we are, but see, they set up barriers in front of the White House fence, and those of us who were arrested leapt the barriers, and then they come and give you 3 warnings to leave, and we didn't leave, and then we were arrested.
Does the uprising in the Middle East give you hope and inspiration?
Yes. I think I worry that we don't have a kind of vision. We don't have the vocabulary by which we can not only describe what's happening to us, but what must take its place. And that is something that, unfortunately, the corporate state has erased from our collective consciousness. There was a broad social vision that was embraced by these movements at the turn of the century. It's how we got the 8-hour workday. It's how we got health insurance. It's how we got retirement benefits. It's how we got, safety inspections within mines. I lived in Egypt for 4 years. I covered the Middle East for 7 years. I was the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times. And, when you target a figure like Mubarak, I mean, the Egyptians are out there again, protesting Field Marshal Tantawi and the military, which Mubarak comes out of. But I really think, we've got to go back. I mean, I'm a socialist, and I think we have to begin to articulate that, because I feel that for those of us who are carrying out nonviolent acts of resistance, we are that last thin line between the protection of a civil society and its breakdown. Because if opposition becomes expressed through the lunatic fringe of the political establishment and the Republican Party, it's going to be fascist. It's going to be terrifying. And it's the best like all conviction and the worst are full of passionate intensity. We're all sitting around waiting for the barbarians at the gate. And I think it is incumbent upon all of us to recognize that we can no longer place our faith in mainstream institutions or the Democratic Party. And what will happen during this election cycle is the Republicans will cough up somebody pretty repugnant. We'll probably be lucky with Mitt Romney. And they'll scare us. And that short-term use of fear has killed us. And I think that my argument, certainly the argument in the death of the liberal class, is that because we keep retreating and not holding fast around these moral imperatives, we are empowering this lunatic fringe. That if we had stood up in 1994 to the Democrats when they passed NAFTA and thrust a knife into the back of the American working class, the working class, we don't have a working class anymore, let's be clear. It's already been destroyed. Now they're destroying the middle class. We might have been able to pressure the power elite to respond to the needs of ordinary citizens. But that constant use of propaganda, that constant manipulation of fear, has rendered us disempowered. I mean, I'm like speechless at what's happening to Bradley Manning. First of all, this guy, and let's be clear about what he was. He was a whistleblower. He exposed crimes, war crimes. And he's not even charged. And he's tortured. And we all know he's being tortured. He's being broken. And it's pure vendetta. It's not like they're trying to get information out of him. They're using the same psychological techniques, isolation, 23 hours a day, you're naked, that they use in Guantanamo to turn people into sort of quivering wrecks. And it's why the Army has so many psychiatrists down in places like Guantanamo, and I'm sure they have psychiatrists watching Manny. They used to say that the Gestapo broke bones and the Stasi broke souls. And that's what we're doing to Manny in public view. And the danger is that if there is instability, we'll all become Bradley Manning. I used to wonder whether Huxley was right or Orwell was right. Is it Brave New World where we all, to steal Postman's word, amuse ourselves to death? Or is it Big Brother and Goldstein and the current security state? It turns out they're both right. First we had Huxley. Well, they took everything away from us. Now we get Orwell. And totalitarian societies, as Orwell noted, rule through fraud and force. And when the fraud is exposed, force is all they have left. So I think for those of us who want to protect what should be protected, we're going to have to stand up in the short term against this pressure. Because if we don't, we will cede rebellion to essentially proto-fascists who, let me just pick on the church, who I think are embodied in the name of my book, it's not for sale out here, but the name of my book on the Christian right is American Fascists, the Christian Right and the War in America. I was trying to reach out to them. And I don't understand how, as I did, you can go through seminary for 3 years and study the Christian Gospels, the Beatitudes, and the teachings of Jesus Christ, and walk out into the wider world and look at a figure like Joel Osteen or Pat Robertson or Rod Parsley and not say anything. If there's any undercurrent of the message of the radical message of the gospel is that it's not going to be easy for you in the world. And the church remained utterly silent, as if they would never have to fight for what it is they believed. And they retreated into this how is it with me spirituality, which is just narcissism. You know, Martin Luther King preached a great sermon called Jesus Did Not Come to Bring Peace of Mind. And so the church, or, you know, and certainly the figures within the church like Berrigan or Coffin or others, and King himself, had constant problems with the institution. But they were there. We got Jim. I think, and that hurts me the most because, there's probably not a Christian church, a denomination that would accept me anymore as a believer. Yet on the other hand, I feel that those moral imperatives, that call to, you know, as Berrigan said, in the end, we're called to do the good, but it's not our job to know where the good goes. We trust, we have faith that it goes somewhere. That's what faith is. But after we do the good, or at least what we can perceive as the good, we have to let it go. And I think that's right. And I think that the, you know, one can look at the moral failing of the secular left that spun out into the weather underground and replicated the paranoia and violence and bigotry and intolerance of the oppressor, and you can look at Berrigan, who 90 years of his life. He was just arrested a year or two ago. I can sort of barely walk. And I think that whether you're religious or not, holding fast to those moral imperatives becomes paramount if there is any hope left in our society. I think Nader doesn't have a religious bone in his body. But Ralph did this. There's a great documentary on Nader called An Unreasonable Man. And in the film, they ask him if he's worried about his legacy by doing this. And Nader said, what are they going to do, take seatbelts out of cars? Nader doesn't care. And he's ornery. I mean, he's a really close friend of mine, and we talk all the time. But, you know, he's everything you'd expect from somebody like that. When people talk about Nader's betrayal, it's not Nader who betrayed us. It's all those people who betrayed the principles that Ralph held fast to. Nobody knows more about corporations or has fought them as successfully. Nor has probably any other single American done more for the average man and woman in this country than Ralph Nader. And, the Democratic Party has been the engine behind trying to destroy him, including challenging all his voting lists. And he was polling about 4 million votes before, 2 or 3 days before the election. About 100,000 people voted for him. And he said, I think people just went in and got scared. I think that's right. I think he was probably polling. And he said, who were the other, and I would give talks against Obama, even in places like Berkeley, and people would hiss and boo and walk out. Kucinich was the one who tipped me off to Obama. Dennis said, when he was a kid in Cleveland, he used to go to the ball games, and the guys would go around going, get your scorecards, get your scorecards. It was the batting record. He said, go back and read Obama's voting record 2 years in the Senate. It's awful. It's one corporate giveaway after another. Don't listen to the public relations. Look at the voting. Look at the scorecard. And I think that's right. But to get up and say that in the euphoria was really difficult. Ralph said, I had you and Patti Smith. So I thought, hey, that's cool. I'll take that.
Are you planning to take Michael Moore with you when you visit Bank of America?
The problem with Michael, I know Michael really well, and I like Michael. I like him a lot. And I have a lot of respect for Michael Moore. But every time elections rolls around, Michael throws his weight behind, which is considerable, behind the Democratic Party. And I break with him on that. I think that's a mistake. And he did on these midterm elections, and I have no doubt that he will in the presidential elections. And I think the Democratic Party is a problem. And I think that if we're not willing to fight for these values, then nobody's going to fight for them. And we have to be willing to accept being outcasts and pariahs and even reviled to a certain extent among, and it's hardest among your friends. But I think it's the only hope we have left. I mean, I think you can look back the last few decades and say the tactics we've employed are not working, and they're not.
Can I ask a question back here? I really wanted to ask you about...
Can you wait for the mic, please?
Yeah, I really wanted to ask you about the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, but I have to ask you about this. You're closer to it than I am, but it seems to me I can't stand Ralph Nader, and I'll never do anything for him. Because it seems to me that his ego got in the way, and he cost the election in Florida. And as a result, 4,400 Americans lost their lives.
All right, let me...
Let me finish my question.
All right.
The bottom line is, I come from the Thornton Cooper philosophy. Any Democrat is better than any Republican. And what has happened is, Bush got elected. We knew this would happen. And we went to war. And these soldiers died. There are untold numbers of maimed, and I don't see how you can square this up. I care about one thing, soldiers who lived, soldiers who died. And the bottom line to me is he cost the election. If you also want to comment on Triangle Shirtwaist I'd welcome that.
Well, let me, on the issue of election, I don't share your opinion that he cost the election. Even Gore is running around saying he won, by the way, now. They very quickly stopped the recounting of the ballots. They only allowed two counties to be recounted in Florida because they knew damn well that Bush had lost. And 375,000 votes had been invalidated. I think the failure, our failure, was to accept that we live in a banana republic and that the Supreme Court overturned all judicial precedent to anoint George W. Bush president. Al Gore ran... You know, as Nader points out, if the Democrats would get up and say, a moratorium on foreclosures and bank repossessions, universal health care for all Americans, a jobs program so that the 1 in 6 American workers who are out of work in this country have a decent job, free public education, including free university education for every student in this country, you think they couldn't win? But they won't say it because they're lackeys of the corporate state. And I think that there's an emotional incapacity on the part of the American public to look back and realize that in 2000 we're no different from Honduras. That's the problem.
There was an old story with Jesus that said, would the adults just get out of the way for a moment and let the children come unto me? There's a young girl back here who's had her hand up. I went in the back, in the way back. If we could just hear from her, it would be very good.
Why did they do mountaintop removals?
I didn't hear the question.
Why did they do mountaintop removals?
Why what? Why did they do mountaintop removal? Because money is the root of all evil.
Several projects on mountaintop removal and trying to raise awareness about it in my area, which is far away from the affected area. But why do you think they would keep on doing it? People have been protesting for it for years, and especially with that one place where there's a coal temple right next to an elementary school.
In Sullivan, right? Marsh, right? Because these people are blinded by the golden calf, by idols of money and power. I mean, it's how Massey Energy can poison all of the aquifers around in the community where Don Blankenship has his estate. And they run a pipe, I guess from Mingo or somewhere, to his house and don't give any water to his neighbors. It is the inability to check figures whose myopic or short-sighted drive is to build pathetic monuments to themselves at the expense of human life. And these people have been with us, you know, since Pharaoh and Ahab, and they're never going to go away. But we have to create societies by which the evil that they inflict is thwarted. And unfortunately, we now live in a society where they have the power and we don't. And we have to take the power back.
Chris, first of all, since the issue of the 2000 election was raised, I think since we're sitting in West Virginia, it bears repeating, that had West Virginia done the right thing and voted as it characteristically had in elections past for the Democratic nominee in 2000 instead of what we did, which was voting for Bush, Florida and Nader wouldn't have mattered, and Al Gore would have been elected. We need to take note of the fact that we liberals, progressives, decent people in this room live in a state that handed George Bush the presidency. It's not all about Florida, and it is certainly not about Ralph Nader. But secondarily to that, and this is my question, is there really an off-ramp to empire? Tonight you've used the words empire, totalitarianism, you've even used the word fascism. And I agree with all three. But is there any coming back from it, or does it merely have to fall apart?
Well, it is falling apart. It's dying. As you know, I'll go back and quote Berrigan. He said, the tragedy isn't that the empire is dying. The tragedy is that we're taking so many people down with us. Look, we maintain empire the same way we maintain our disgusting levels of consumption through credit, through borrowing, through debt. And it's not a sustainable system. And nobody's talking about reconfiguring the system to make it work, as if the Chinese will buy $2 billion a debt forever. And we're running up the largest deficits in human history, $12.8 trillion, which by the time we have to service them, according to Michael Hudson, will mean selling $96 billion of debt a week. We're trying to monetize our debt by, printing $600 billion in currency. Now, I'm not an economist. Maybe these people are right. Maybe the fact that the dollar is the reserve currency of the world will protect us. But I have lived through three currency collapses, Argentina, Nicaragua, and Yugoslavia. And when a currency collapses, and it collapses like popping a balloon, suddenly all the banks are closed. There's no warning. When you have a currency collapse, all formal or what are deemed legitimate systems of power are instantly discredited. And then the people who, large segments of the population, relegated as insane, figures like Radovan Karadzic, for instance, take power. They fill the vacuum because of the anger. Once a currency collapses, instantly the moral order is turned upside down, so that you see the gangsters driving through Belgrade in their black Mercedes, the speculators, the war profiteers, and all of the responsible citizens who worked hard, put a little money aside every month, or living on pensions, are bankrupt. I mean, I used to drive past the bread lines in Belgrade, and it would be long, long line, block long, several blocks long, of the elderly waiting for soup. People who'd worked 40 years in a factory, and suddenly whatever check they got was not enough to feed them for a week. That's what happens. So what we're watching with Geithner and Bernanke and Summers and all these figures is that they're trying to create inflation. They want inflation because 4 or 5% inflation reduces the debt service by a significant amount. But can you control inflation? It's a very, very dangerous game. I mean, if you read the studies by economists, including economists who support what's being done, they all agree that it's a Hail Mary, and that if it doesn't work, it's catastrophic. And I think we're playing a really dangerous game. I'm not trying to predict what's going to happen because I don't have the expertise to predict it. I think that if we can stave off a currency collapse, we can perhaps hold these lunatic forces at bay, who I find very frightening. But in the event of a currency collapse, Obama, they're all finished. The mainstream Republicans are finished. They're all finished. So the empire is dying. We are dying as all empires die, which is you hollow the empire out from the inside. You you collapse from the inside. I mean, literally, our infrastructure is collapsing. The desolation that you see in West Virginia is being replicated across the American landscape, Michigan, Ohio, New Jersey. And now we're living through a period where there are even more draconian cuts. I mean, mothers go to Head Start facilities in the morning. They don't know if it's going to be open or closed. That's how empires die. They eat themselves out from the inside out. And that's what's happening. The political and social consequences of that are terrifying.
Folks, we have time for two more, I think.
If we could have a couple more comments, I'd like to close with a comment. And then Chris will be signing books in the back again, be able to talk to some of you individually. It's been a long day for him. I know he's had a trip in here. So maybe a couple more questions. I'd like to make a final comment. And then wish you well.
Thank you. First, I just want to commend you. I had written a paper myself in my freshman year for the Committee on Public Information, and I found it an extraordinarily daunting task. I could not find good research materials on the subject. Now, that was several years ago. It was also several years before the Internet. But also,
I didn't use the internet to write about. I didn't. I was.
Well, you didn't have to. Judging from the sources that you had available. But I also wanted to bring up sort of an historical point, and that is, I haven't read your book, but it seems to me my recollection of history, if we go back to the turn of the century, Henry Adams, who had written Democracy maybe 20 or 30 years earlier, wrote a memoir. And that memoir was a very, very bleak accounting for what he believed was the prospect for the future of this country. He was extremely pessimistic. He thought that that the ruling elites of the time had it pretty much locked up. Now, what you mentioned is that in that time period, aside from maybe William Jennings Bryan and a couple of others, that there were people at the time who had found a way. They had found weak spots. And they did, over a 20 to 25-year period, build a movement, which, as you point out, was ultimately subverted. But they did make a great deal of progress in over a number of years. And what I'd like to ask you is, do you think there are weak points now in the power elites in this country that, you know, maybe we ought to be a little bit more cognizant of in terms of our ability to organize now? Thank you.
Yeah, of course there are weak points, because 70% of the U.S. economy is driven by consumption. So the more you sever yourselves from the tentacles of the consumer state, the weaker they become. Pull your money out of their banks. I think food, sustainable agriculture, is a huge issue. And I think that, I mean, one of the things that has also haunted me about coming to West Virginia is the fact that I use electricity. And in a way, I can make fun of Don Blankenship, but I'm paying him. I am. I'm paying him. You know, I'm locked into that system. I'm driving a car. And it may come to the point where we just have to begin that. That's the only weapon we have left. I pay my taxes. I wrote an article for The Nation that said if we went to war with Iran, I would no longer pay my income taxes. But I probably shouldn't be paying my taxes now. And I mean, those are questions I really think a lot about. Because I think there are weapons, but I think it entails such a radical change of lifestyle and a certain degree of hardship. But I think think about those things a lot.
And our final question.
What do you think will be like for my generation, and how do you think that we will deal with the problems of, like, the economy of the world?
I think your generation will look back on my generation and go, why did they do this to us? Why didn't they stand up and say something? I mean, I got four kids. My youngest kid is 2 months old. And I may not be able to stop the assault, but it's not about me anymore. It's all about them. It's all about you. And all of us who come from an older generation, I think, have a moral duty to your generation to fight back. Because if we don't fight back, number one, there's no hope. But number two, the ecological and economic devastation will make huge swathes of the planet Earth uninhabitable.
One quick announcement and then a kind of final word. David and a couple of people who could just be in the back there, maybe Joy and some folks I see in the back, there are a couple of baskets back in the back behind the screen here. In order to meet some of the costs that we've had for this, by the way, Chris gave us this lecture tonight. But we got a couple of expenses, so if you want to drop something that hits the plate back there without making any noise, we would appreciate it. It would be really nice. So with that in mind, Chris, we'll have him come out down in a minute so he can sign books in the back and talk with folks. One final comment. First, I want to thank all the people that worked on this, Gary and David and Paul and Eva, my God, and just the folks that helped put this together. We couldn't have done it without Chris, and we really thank you for that. And we look forward to what you're going to be writing about us here. And because he said earlier today that he goes places and his books have been written. I love this. Books are written by people who don't know anything about what they're writing about. He didn't say it quite like that, but you know, you go to find out what's there, and you listen, and you learn, and you write from that. And that's what he gives us all the time. I want to close with a quote here tonight. I.F. Stone, he mentioned I.F. Stone, is one of the great, great writers, great, great journalist, and more than a journalist. I get this question all the time. You sometimes, Lewis, you act like you enjoy the conflict that you're in. I don't always. But you know, we need to really find a way to enjoy the conflict we're in. I mean that. We really do, because we're going to lose a lot of times. We've got to be looking back. By the way, I think tonight, as I've heard Chris speak here, and by the way, he doesn't like me to say this, but I see him as a prophetic figure, speaking prophetic words to us, not about the future, yeah, not so much what the future will be, because he can't tell us, but rather what's going on now that we need to face up to in order to deal with the future. So I really appreciate that for him. I know he spoke tonight earlier about a child that he just had and a baptism. And that really, what will these kids say when they look back and see the pictures of us? What will they say? What will they say about the history that we've been writing? I know in my church, we look back a lot at the history. Oh, by golly, we look back a lot. But what are they going to say about what we're doing here? And by the way, did they enjoy the fight? I.F. Stone said this. It's really kind of sobering. He said, the only kinds of fights worth fighting are those you're going to lose because somebody has to fight them. And lose and lose and lose until someday somebody who believes as you do wins. In order for somebody to win an important major fight 100 years hence, I hope sooner, a lot of other people have got to be willing for the sheer fun and joy of it to go right ahead and keep fighting, even knowing that they may lose. And he closes with this. You mustn't feel like a martyr. You've got to enjoy it. We're here tonight. We look back. We celebrated just last week the martyrdom of Archbishop Romero in El Salvador. Was it senseless? Was it a losing battle? Things are not pretty in El Salvador right now. But was it worth it? We celebrated Dr. King here. He died in front of a lousy motel. Was it worth it? Was it worth it? And here in West Virginia, we've just been remembering the miners who died. Did they die for nothing? I think only we will answer that. I think only we will. Because the fights are ahead of us. I don't know how much time you have. I mean, none of us know. The guys in prison teach me that we're all doing time, and none of us knows how much. And what are we doing with it? So the questions hang out there that the fights are there. We may be losing some struggles, but we get up and we fight again. Because our kids, your daughter, will look back and say, did they fight the fight? And will we continue to keep that fight up until the justice is done, the peace is in order, and people are living as people as God meant them to live on this earth? Okay, I'm going to have Chris go down the aisle. Again, I think we need to say thank you to him for this lecture here tonight. And thank you. Let's get down right down here.